Just as we prepare then to listen to David and God's word to us today, I just want to encourage you to be open, ready to hear what God will be saying to you right now, today. Okay? Let's go.
Hello, my name is David, and I lead Grace Church across all our three sites. I'm in our Bognor site this morning, but across all three sites, Bognor and Chichester and Midhurst, we are starting a new preaching series this morning, which I'm very excited about. I'd like to start by reading a passage from the book of Acts. So if you've not turned there already, then please do. From Acts chapter 13 and verse 16 says this: "Standing up, Paul motioned with his hand and said, 'Fellow Israelites and you Gentiles who worship God, listen to me. The God of the people of Israel chose our ancestors. He made the people prosper during their stay in Egypt. With mighty power, he led them out of that country. For almost 40 years, he endured their conduct in the wilderness. And he overthrew seven nations in Canaan, giving their land to his people as their inheritance. All this took about 450 years. After this, God gave them judges until the time of Samuel the prophet. Then the people asked for a king, and he gave them Saul, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, who ruled for 40 years. After removing Saul, he made David their king. God testified concerning him, 'I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do.'" One of my favourite pastimes is people watching. If I'm sat by myself in a public place with time to kill, for example, in an airport departure lounge or on a bench in a town centre, I know it's a bit of an old man thing to do. And potentially it sounds a bit creepy, but I just love it. And it's an activity that's as old as the hills. It's just sitting there and just observing people who walk past, who are around me. I find myself wondering what their lives are like and wondering what sort of people they are, thinking, would I like to be in their shoes? Obviously based on wild supposition and no knowledge at all. But there is a book in the Bible which is the result of someone doing just that, people watching. One guy observing the lives of people around him. And that's the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. The book describes a teacher, someone who has studied people from all different walks of life with different experiences of life, and he has analysed them because he wants to find meaning and purpose in life. And he's asking, at the end of the day, what is the point? What's the point of life? And the conclusion that he keeps coming back to is perhaps a surprising one. It is that every stage of life, every pursuit of life is meaningless. Chapter 1, verse 2 of Ecclesiastes says, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." That word in Hebrew translated meaningless is the word hebel, which is a tricky word to translate. It's actually a tricky word to say, but it's a hard word to translate accurately, hebel. Literally, it means vapour or smoke. It's something that's elusive and fleeting. You think it's there and then you try and grasp hold of it and it's gone. And that word hebel is used 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. Everything is hebel, meaningless. And although Ecclesiastes was written around 3,000 years ago, there is something timeless about the observation of life that makes that book just as relevant today with all our modern sophistication as it ever was then. It describes how people give their whole lives to the pursuit of things that ultimately count for nothing, like vapor. It describes how people give their lives to the pursuit of pleasure and wealth and career. Even wisdom and understanding. It's not that any of those things are bad. But when that is the main thing that people have tried to grasp hold of in life, they find that one day it's not even there. It's gone. It's vapor. And the teacher in Ecclesiastes also observes how people try really hard to do well in life and then bad things happen that cause them hurt and pain. In fact, bad things happen to people who try hard in life just as much to the people who don't try at all. And so he asks, well, what's the point then? It's like chasing after the wind. It's vapor. It's vanity. It's meaningless. But throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, there is also the perspective of a sovereign and loving God. After all his observations, the teacher concludes that whatever stage of life you are in, whatever the experience of your life has been, you had better accept that your life on this earth is incredibly brief. You better enjoy it while it lasts. And most importantly, recognize that the only way to find meaning and purpose in life is to look to God. Take a step back and see your place in his eternal plan. He is the God of time and eternity. Only he can give you meaning, and he does. So over these next 7 weeks, we're going to look at different stages in life and different life events that are common in our society. And in each case, we're going to consider, what does the Bible teach us on this subject? What is heaven's perspective on this season that I am in? Where is God at work? Because if you can answer that, then you find that your life is far from being meaningless. Your life has eternal purpose, and your destiny is in God. So over these coming weeks, we're going to look at singleness and dating and marriage. We're going to consider divorce and being single again. We're going to look at living with long-term illness. We're going to look at that bit of life when you are a hands-on parent. We're going to look at the second half of life from middle age into retirement. And we're also going to look at handling disappointment and things you regret from your past. So that's all to come in the coming weeks. Now, clearly, in tackling a preaching series like this, not everything will apply directly to everyone every week. We can't all be single and retired and parents all at the same time. But I encourage you to engage fully in this whole series. Don't miss a week. And here's why. Firstly, even if you are not in a particular season yourself, you may be one day. And it's good to get a foundation of biblical truth. Secondly, even if you are not in a particular season yourself, you may know someone who is, or you may know someone who will be soon. And so it's good to get a foundation of biblical truth. And then thirdly, it's simply good to get a foundation of biblical truth. We're not here to try and learn some religious dogma. God is our Father. Even with all the complexities of life, our Father holds us in his hand. Let that build your faith throughout this series. So our title for this morning is Setting Out in Life. But first, I thought it would be good to hear from someone younger than myself. So we're just going to hear from Johnny May.
So I'm here with Johnny May, who's part of our Chichester site. Johnny, tell us where you're at in your life right now. What are you up to?
Sure. So I'm married to Caris. We're based at the Chichester site, like you said. We've been married about a year and a half now. And I am currently halfway through a PGCE training to become an RE teacher in a secondary school.
Great. We're talking about setting out in life. Tell us, what's one of the difficult things about setting out on your life journey in 2018?
I think one big thing, just quite a general thing, is just to do with how people communicate, really. So social media is kind of like the big thing, and I know that with kids at school it's an absolutely massive thing. I think it just changes the way we talk to each other, in the way we access information. I think it just adds a kind of superficiality to everything. I think partly it makes kind of people just a bit accepting sometimes of different stuff. So often when I talk to people, they're absolutely fine with the fact that I'm a Christian, they think that's good for you. But it's kind of trying to communicate to them, actually, you know, you need to make a response as well. It's not just for me, it's for you as well.
Yeah, right. Okay, when you get to the end of your life and you look back, what kind of life do you hope to have led? What do you hope it to have looked like?
I think by the end of my life, I'd like to get to the point where I can just say, actually, you know, I've served God with my life. I've been obedient to what he's doing. I'm confident that actually I'm going to be with him, and he's going to say, you did a good job. You did what I asked you to do. And that's what I'd like for me and my family.
Great.
So, setting out in life. I'm talking about the season of life when you have reached adulthood. So you're not a child anymore, but you would consider that life is ahead of you. You're setting out in life, maybe beginning to establish a career or thinking of starting your own family. You're probably in your 20s or your 30s. Now, me, myself, I'm a little more than that. I am 45. And that's halfway to 90. And 90, by any estimate, would be a good innings. I guess I am legitimately labelled as entering middle age. And from this lofty position, I begin to look ahead to what the second half of my life might hold. Of course, it might all be over tomorrow, and that would also be fine. But I also look back to the last 25 years or so, and I can remember how I viewed life when I was setting out. In fact, it seems like yesterday that I was a student, that I was setting out into a career in engineering, and life was ahead of me. I was penniless and clueless, but ready to take on the world. And so you might be setting out in life, or you might know someone who is. I want to talk about appearances. I want to talk about ambition and then fear. Let's talk about appearances first. The Bible describes two people who were setting out in life. Both were kings. One was Saul and the other was David. They were the first two kings of Israel. And this was after a period of around 300 years when Israel was overseen by a series of judges. And you can read about that in the book of Judges. The last of those judges was a prophet named Samuel. The people went to Samuel and they said, "Every other nation around us has a king. So we want a king to rule over us." And they looked at Samuel, and he was quite old by this point. They looked at Samuel's sons, but they were basically crooks. So they said to him, "Find us a king." Well, the first king that God directed Samuel to was a young man named Saul. If this was X Factor or Celebrity Jungle Bake Off, then Saul was exactly the sort of person that you could see being chosen as king. This is how Saul is described. He, that's Kish, Saul's dad, had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than all the others. As Saul was setting out in life, he was probably the envy of every other man in Israel and probably the secret heartthrob of every woman. He was impressive. He was tall. He was a handsome warrior. He was definitely king material. As you set out in life, it's easy to look at other people and think they are the ones who are going to be successful. They're the ones who have got what it takes in life. They've got the looks, they've got the brains, they've got that family money behind them, they've got that easy, winsome charm. Of course they're going to be successful. Now, Saul was indeed anointed as first king over Israel, but he was not successful. In fact, it seems that God appointed Saul as king really as a backdrop, as a contrast to the man that he had really chosen as king, the man that he had chosen to establish his covenant with, the covenant that would be fulfilled in his direct descendant, Jesus, the Messiah. And that king was David. When David was setting out, he was far from impressive. He was the youngest son in a big family. He was often overlooked and given the duff jobs that no one else wanted to do, like looking after the little flock of sheep in the desert while his brothers got to go and do more exciting stuff. God sent Samuel to find the next king, and Samuel said to God, well, how am I going to know him? How am I going to recognize him? It's a sensible question, right? And God replied, well, for one thing, don't look at the outward appearance. Don't look for someone who is tall and muscular. This is what God actually says. He says, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. That was David's brother who looked a lot like Saul. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. David was not an obvious candidate for success, but God knew his heart. God had done what he had promised he would do, which was to seek out a man after my own heart. In other words, David's heart of care and compassion and righteousness was the same as God's. So the way that he would live and relate to others would be an exact representation of how God relates to us. When setting out in life, probably the number one question to ask is, what sort of person is God looking for to be influential in his kingdom? What is going to make my life a success? Not a success in the world's eyes, in terms of money and power and status, all the things that the teacher in Ecclesiastes says are meaningless vapor, but rather success in God's eyes. It's not the people who our society would naturally gravitate to and idolize. Rather, it's the people whose heart aligns with God's heart. Are you one of those people? As you set out in life, don't worry about appearances. They can be deceiving. Let the Holy Spirit transform your heart. Be a worshipper. Pursue holiness above everything else. Be a heart man or a heart woman for God. And everything else will fall into its place. So let's talk about ambition. When I was beginning my career in engineering, I had just graduated with a good degree. I'd landed a job in a successful firm at the cutting edge of technology. I was going to take the world by storm. And it's not just that I was after money and success, or although maybe that featured in my thinking a little bit. It was more this. It was more that I knew that God had called me into engineering. He had shaped my character and my gifting, and he had enabled me to be trained. And now I wanted to be the very best engineer that I could be. In that sense, I had ambition. It's normal when you're setting out in life with your life and your career stretched out in front of you to have ambition. Now, some people in their personality will be more ambitious than others, and that's okay. The question is it right for a Christian to have ambition? Maybe there's a bit in our brain somewhere that thinks having ambition, isn't that a bit worldly? Isn't that a bit selfish? and therefore perhaps sinful. Good Christians don't have ambition. So what does the Bible say on this? Well, firstly, it says this: be ambitious for God's glory. When a person becomes a Christian, they are a new creation, made spiritually alive to God. The Holy Spirit works in you to change you bit by bit into something more Christ-like, something that brings glory to God. But that's a process. Our bodies are weak. We are prone to listen to temptation. And there remains a strong desire in all of us to bring glory to ourselves. The Bible calls that the flesh. It's the bit in you that just loves to sin. The pursuit of glory is a never-ending battle between the spirit and the flesh. So take me, for example. I want to become a better preacher. Now, maybe you want that for me too. But one minute, my desire is rooted in a godly desire to use the gifting that God has given me to serve the church well, to bring people increasingly into truth. And then the next minute, I find my thinking has changed, and suddenly I'm thinking, I could look really good here. I could make a name for myself. I get a bit of profile. But what will people think of me? How will people judge me? And there's this glory battle going on. Now, I think we all live with a glory battle going on inside of us to one extent or another. When you are thinking about how your life will unfold, ask yourself this question: whose glory am I living for? There's a story in Acts chapter 14. It's over the page from the passage I read at the start. And it describes how Paul and Barnabas, they went on from Antioch, where they were before. They went on to a place called Lystra. And there they healed a man who had been unable to walk his entire life. And when the crowd saw this happen, they went wild. You can just imagine it, can't you? There's these two men and there's this other guy who had never walked and now he's walking around. And so the crowd, it was like a riot, and they started to worship Paul and Barnabas like they were Greek gods come down in the flesh or something like that. And Paul's response to this was to say, "Friends, why are you doing this? We too are only human like you. We are bringing you the good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them." Now, in Paul's response there, you see a little three-step program right there for maintaining godly ambition. Step one is see who God is. Step two is see who you are. And then step three is ask yourself what you are trying to achieve. You see, firstly, Paul's whole focus was on the living God. He was the one with the power. And it is God who is alive today, and it is God who is present in your life, and it's him who will fulfill his promises over you. He is at work in your life. Keep God's center focus. Not only that, Paul had a right assessment of himself. He said to the crowd, "Hey, I'm just a guy like you. There's nothing intrinsically special about me. I'm just a guy." Well, you, me, all of us, we are just clay in the hands of the potter. It's by God's grace that he has entered into your life. It's by his grace that he's offered you salvation and redeemed your life from the ugliness of sin. And then finally, Paul was clear what he was trying to achieve. He said, we're bringing you good news. He said, this is what we're trying to do here. We're trying to tell you about Jesus. Take a look at your life and ask yourself, what am I trying to achieve? What is my goal? Say, for example, you are setting out in a career as a teacher. Ask yourself, what am I trying to achieve in my teaching career? If it's to earn stack loads of money, well, you're probably in the wrong job. But if it is to equip a new generation of children and prepare them for life in a whole and godly way, then that's a godly ambition. That's a good ambition to have. So who is God? Who am I? What am I doing? What am I trying to achieve? Keep those questions in mind and you will know whose glory you are living for. Be ambitious for the glory of God. Why did David go on to defeat Goliath? Well, it's because he was passionate for the glory of God. Compare that attitude to Saul. He was only ever interested in his own glory. Once when Samuel was looking for him and asked where he was, then he was told, oh, Saul, he's gone to Mount Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honour. And then secondly, when it comes to ambition, be patient in the unfolding of God's plan. Ambition can so easily manifest itself as impatience, or even worse, manipulation. And that was a key difference between Saul and David. The prophet Samuel gave the new king Saul instructions to wait for him before he offered sacrifices to God. But in the heat of the moment, Saul ignored those instructions and he went ahead anyway. And that was the first example of Saul taking matters into his own hands and the first indication that he was not the one that God wanted to head the line of kings over Israel that would ultimately lead to Jesus. David, on the other hand, well, he knew that he had been anointed as king. He knew that that was where his destiny lay, but still he was content to serve. Carrying around other people's stuff, playing music on demand. Even when he was given the opportunity time and again to kill Saul, which would have elevated him instantly to the throne, he just wouldn't take it. And his friends around him were saying, come on, David, this is the moment you've been waiting for. Just bend a few rules and what God has promised to you will be yours. But he wouldn't do it. God had anointed Saul as king. And for all his failures, he wouldn't make a move about the one that God had anointed. In your own life, ambition may well come from a calling that God has placed on your life. Yeah, I've come to realise that in life you really only get time to do one or two things well. But even so, be patient. Let God lead you step by step in his timing. And whatever you do, don't act unrighteously. Don't manipulate or deceive others. Don't step on other people in order to get where you want to go. I'm always so impressed with Ali's my wife. I'm always impressed with her patience in the whole area of God's calling on her life. You see, I'm a strategist. I see where I want to go and I plot a course to get there. And I'm naturally impatient if I can't take the next step. And I think, come on, we can make this happen. Ali, on the other hand, she just seems to flow with the wind of God's spirit. And God uses her powerfully. It's quite frustrating. If you don't know, she's given her life to working with people in crisis pregnancy situations or coping with the effects of having had an abortion. And she currently works with local charities up and down the country that work in this area. And she's passionate about it. But she also holds it lightly. And I'm thinking, come on, you could build an empire. Just get these people on board and spin it this way and present it like this. And for God's glory, of course. And she just prays, gets a sense of where the Spirit is leading and pushes on a door. And often it opens and sometimes it doesn't. And that's okay. But when I look back at what she has achieved over the decades, it's amazing. And God is redeeming my character at the same time. Saul forced his future into being. David took years in preparation before God brought him into the thing that he had been called to do. So as you set out in life, be patient. Walk closely with God, especially if you are not sure yet what your life is actually going to be spent doing, or what job you will have, or what you will give yourself to. Know this, everything in your life is preparation for the next thing that God will call you to do. When David was looking after sheep in the desert, day in, day out, he could well have been wondering what his life was going to amount to. Little did he know that God was preparing him to be the shepherd of the whole nation. And when he killed lions and bears, God was preparing him to tackle the nation's enemies like Goliath. I started out as an engineer, and then I ended up leading a church. But that time in engineering prepared me massively for the work I do now. It taught me grace-filled leadership and much more besides that I won't go into now. When I think of all the time I spent under the preaching of men like Greg Haslam and John Groves, God was preparing me. As part of Steve Petch's eldership team here in Grace Church, God was preparing me. And even now, God will be preparing me for something, whatever and whenever that may come about. And one day, I'll be right in the middle of something and God will call me to glory. And that's okay too. It's good to have godly ambition that is rooted in God's glory. Just be patient and walk closely with him. And just before I finish, I'm aware that as well as setting out in life with a sense of ambition, it's also possible to have a very different emotion as you look to the future. And that is one of fear. In Ecclesiastes, the teacher makes the observation that God has given us enough knowledge to know that there is a future, but does not allow us to see what that future is in advance. He says this in chapter 3, verse 11. He says, he has set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. And in the absence of knowledge about your future, you can either be in faith or you can be in fear. Well, come on, if you are in your teens or in your 20s or in your 30s, be in faith, not fear. When Samuel went to anoint king, went to anoint Saul as king, he couldn't find Saul anywhere. And they looked for him, and in the end they prayed that God would find their new king for them and show them where Saul was. And it turned out that Saul was petrified. And so, even as a grown man, he'd hidden himself under the luggage. And so he hoped he wouldn't be found. I'm not sure how he thought that was going to play out. But that's what he did anyway. He saw his future before him and he was afraid. As a young person setting out in life, there may be plenty that you could be afraid of. Will I live up to my parents' expectations? Will I copy my parents' mistakes? Will I earn enough to be independent? Will I get married and settle down and have a family? Will I stay healthy? And so on it goes. Saul was a guy who buried his head in the suitcases. Now David, on the other hand, he seemed to exhibit no such fear. He got on with his life. And even when challenges came along, he saw them not as portenders of doom, but as opportunities for God to further prepare him for the future that God had revealed to him. David's confidence, even when faced with an enemy like Goliath, came from his close walk with his father God. God had placed his spirit in him. Now, in the Old Testament, having the spirit fill you like that was more of a rare occurrence. Now we live in the new covenant, and God has poured out his spirit on all people. God intends you to walk forward into life, into a life full of the spirit, with all the power that was available to King David. You see, firstly, the spirit enabled David to defeat the lions and the bears and the Goliaths, and then to lead the people with wisdom and justice. And God will give you gifts. He will train and he will equip you for every purpose that he will call you into in your life. He won't send you out empty. He is the divine enabler, and he will prepare you and gift you. Secondly, the Spirit gave David a deep sense of security. The very worst thing that could happen is that he would die and he'd go to be with his God forever. Seeing his life in God's hands gave him great security. Someone said this: divine enablement and divine security gives a man or woman who trusts in God great courage. So be filled with the Spirit and walk forward with courage into every plan, every purpose that God has for your life. Ecclesiastes 11 verse 10 talks about youth, and it says this: youth and vigour are meaningless. Many people try to hold on to their youth with plastic surgery and freezing brain cells and whatever it is they do. But if the whole purpose of life is to stay young, then you really are chasing after the wind. Life has meaning when you find your purpose in God. And that's true at every stage and every season of life. But it certainly is true when you are setting out in life. Ecclesiastes also says this: you who are young, be happy while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Thank you.
Cool. That's so helpful, isn't it? You know, those questions. Maybe the band can, you can start to come up. Those things that he was asking us, whose glory are you living for? It's actually a question for each of us, isn't it? And are you patient for God's unfolding plan? Are you in faith or in fear? And, you know, I remember when I was young in my 20s and just getting ready to come out, you know, go out into the life, getting ready to get married, getting ready to step out into all the things that God might have called for me. I remember for me, the biggest thing wasn't necessarily like being ambitious for God and perhaps myself too, but it was my character. And, you know, this, we live in a society, don't we, which says, it's all about you, go after your glory, and it, character kind of doesn't really matter. It doesn't play a part, does it? And yet, it's so important, isn't it? Because God, he looks at the heart, doesn't he? He looks at the heart. And what I'd like us to do, I'd like us to, in a moment, I'm going to ask those in their teens and their 20s and 30s to stand. And I'd like the rest of us to gather around and pray for them. Because, you know, these things, because of this culture that we live in, we are called to be a heart or a heart man or heart woman for God, aren't we? And it's difficult for all of us, isn't it? It's so difficult in this age. So difficult for those people in this society to have good character. And as they look on and see the things that they've got ahead for them, it's so easy to have fear, isn't it? And yet we're called to have faith. We're called to be people of faith. So if that's you, if you're in your teens or your 20s, if you're in your 30s, can you stand? Do it now. I just want to encourage you. God has a plan and a purpose for you. He has that for each and every one of us. But we might be at the earlier end of it. And I just sense in his spirit right now, just be open to him. Just open up your heart to him in whatever way you feel comfortable. Because he wants to fill you with his Holy Spirit. He wants to give you strength. He wants to speak life into you. He wants to, those character traits, those habitual sins that you've been falling into, he wants to knock them off. And he's saying, are you with me? Are you in? I believe God this morning wants to birth in you his spirit of faith, his spirit of ambition for his glory, that in this society we might see him who is over all things glorified, raised up and risen. We might see him as a banner over Facebook, over social media, over mental health, over all the things that come and bring destruction and death and pain. It's about his glory.